Accession number 12707, Captain Frank Bruce, Reel 7.
Captain HCF Brewis, Reel 7. What was the effect on the men's morale and their eagerness as you moved from a holding battalion to a coastal battalion and then into this much more highly charged training, exercising active role?
Well, of course, it was a tremendous change from being on beach defence. I don't think the troops saw much beyond platoon level. And when they were back in billets in the town, they were back as a company. But apart from the one big march that we did with the regimental band, when the whole of the unit was on parade, the company was the limit of their vision. Well, it was vastly more interesting being in reserve. We weren't actually called out to practice a reinforcement of the beaches, as far as I can remember. But they mightily enjoyed the field firing exercises in North Yorkshire. Didn't enjoy the route march very much, but and we bivouacked. We bivouacked there, and by this time they were getting hardened up. And when it went onto the demonstration battalions, well, that was a big boost. They thought, well, they could have picked so-and-so, the 8th East Yorks, or can't remember some of the other units. But they picked us. And the experience was widening. On one occasion, in that attack that we did on Leeming Aerodrome at one stage, we had a bit of anti-gas training, because a Lysander came over and dropped a mustard gas substitute. Back in Hartlepool, we'd also rigged up a gas chamber, and everybody went through with and, you know, tear gas, with and without respirators.
Were you getting any additional weapons to what you'd had?
We got some Canadian Ross rifles to supplement the Lee Enfields. I think they've been increased since 1918.
And what was your opinion of that rifle?
I don't think it was liked as much as the Lee Enfield. They'd just begun to get used to the Lee Enfield. And I don't think it was a wholesale changeover. I think I only know at that stage of D Company getting them issued instead.
Did they match for ammunition, the two rifles?
Yeah, it was 303. Yeah. They'd been used firing 303 in the First World War.
Were you exercising with any other arms of the military and naval air force?
I don't think so. Except this single Lysander. No, not at that stage. I don't think we had many tanks left after Dunkirk.
What were the feelings of yourselves and the countryside at large with the sequence of disasters at the early stages of the war? You'd had Dunkirk, and there we were. Was this having any effects?
I was personally not in very close touch with the civvies in the area. I can't remember much about the press in those days. I think we were a bit cocooned. And didn't see much further than the immediate job in hand. I think the concentration was to get on with it and get properly trained.
Were you motorised for movement?
Except for the buses, with the one bus driver deficient. When they went as the demonstration battalion, they were bussed. When we went to Sheffield by train, when we went to Hull by train. Maybe I can come back to Hull now. This reconnaissance had to be done very much on the quiet, because the units in the Beverly Hull area were to wake up one morning and find the enemy in their midst. And I had bothered with a motorcycle on the way back. And as luck would have it, the only truck that stopped was from a DLI battalion. And the officer on board said, "Oh, let's get it piled on here. We'll take it back and get it fixed with you and come have a meal in the mess." And lots of questions about what was I doing in the area and so on. Can't remember how I managed to put them off, but rigged up some cock and bull story to explain that I was coming back from further afield and just passing through. Anyway, train arrived overnight. No, beg your pardon. Train arrived early evening. It must have been late autumn or early winter. Late evening through Hull, and went in with blinds drawn on the train, but the odd peek out and we saw what bombing really looked like. Hull was an absolute mess. And when the cooks set up for the first meal, they had a petrol fire, and some silly bod threw water on it. The local wardens descended on us, and the invective, after what they'd been through, the last thing they wanted was half the countryside lit up. And the exercise, I think, served its purpose. We managed to put the wind up in various areas, because the companies were pretty well scattered to appear a larger force than we actually were. And I think the troops enjoyed that a great deal. I know the one little group very much enjoyed bringing in a captured signals truck. I remember our signal officer, Johnny Rand, trying to bluff his way through on their net to try and find out some of their plans. But of course it didn't work.
Were you still the intelligence officer at this stage?
At that stage, yes.
And which brigade were you attached to?
We were in 217 Infantry Brigade, headquarters at Wynyard Hall, between Stockton and Sedgefield. Again, part of the Durham and North Riding Division. Commanding officer was Major General, can't remember his initials, Shears. And that gave rise to part of the cloth insignia we wore on battle dress, which was Shears in the form of the old sheep clippers in yellow on a green background. He came and inspected us, and I think we got a good report. The whole battalion was on parade at Sedgefield, and he came to one fella at Geordie, and he was rather taken aback by the answer to his question, what did you do in Civvy Street before the war? And this Geordie voice said, I minded my own business, sir. And the CO hastily had to explain that minding his own business didn't mean what the general thought it was, meant that he ran his own business. I saw him later on another occasion when I was on an MCO course, that's Motor Contact Officers course, at divisional headquarters at Darlington. Basically, it was a glorified officer dispatch rider. But there was more, a bit more to it than that, because it quite often, in exercises, meant moving between divisional headquarters and with confirmation of written orders to brigadiers and so on. And in exercises, they would have been put up to it. So, of course, you know, I got on more than one occasion that general would never issue an order like that. And one had to do one's best to convince him. Well, I remember one day overstepping the mark and said, well, sir, why don't you ring up divisional headquarters and find out for yourself? However, that attitude didn't enamour me at brigade headquarters.
You've mentioned that you did live in bivouacs for certain parts of your schemes and exercises, Captain, and Sedgefield Racecourse and other places. Where were you finding yourselves accommodated, and what exactly were they like?
Oh, Sedgefield, racecourse buildings, some of them in the tote, Nissen huts to supplement the racecourse buildings. I think I'd already said that A Company were in a pre-war hutted establishment. Can't for the life of me remember where B... Oh, no, they were at Sedgefield. But D Company, and at this stage, I was with D Company at Wolveston Hall. But the hall itself was partly closed off with furniture stored in it. The sort of what had been servants' quarters. There was one large room where the company officers, where they lived, and if I remember, straw palliasses, no beds. Company commander had a small bedroom to himself, company sergeant major and the CQMS, but the men were in bell tents. There was a not a very large, well, there wasn't a large estate attached to the hall, but there was an area of, a copse down one part of the estate wall, a fairly open copse where bell tents were erected in the gaps. And I don't know why. I should think it was probably there were a couple of snorers among the company officers. But for a greater part of the time when I was back at D Company, I lived in the bell tent as well. And I could face the men, because at that time, Rupert Blackett, the company commander, was away on a course, I think, and I was acting company commander at the time.
Was there much resentment in conditions like that, where the officers were in what appeared to be reasonable accommodation and the men were roughing it? Was there much said about this?
Well, it was partly to counteract the possibility of that I chose to live in a bell tent. I think they would know that, apart from the fact that they had a roof over their head and under four brick walls, that the rest of the officers were living were sleeping on palliasses, and we had the same grub, by and large, as them.
What the kind of food were you getting?
I can't honestly remember a great deal. I seem to remember stewed sheep's heart for breakfast on one occasion in a rich brown gravy. I think we all, the men at the local fish and chip shop, did good business to supplement what we had.
Was there any kind of supplementing the ration through naffies or?
No, there was no naffy anywhere. There wasn't a Church of Scotland canteen anywhere near Wolverston, now Kentley Durham either. It must have been adequate. I think we were probably so hungry, because again there was a great deal of stress on physical fitness and PT and route marches, as well as company exercises. I organised one company exercise during that period where I was acting company commander. There was a reservoir not far from Wolverston, a comfortable route march. And I had Charles Bowdrey, A Company, as an umpire to oversee this little effort. And I got a good report, which I think led to my second pip, probably. Or was it the third? I'm a bit vague. I think he was more impressed with what the company sergeant major had done about bringing up the rations to the right spot at the right time, as much as any tactical moves on my part. My batman was then acting as company runner, looking a ton weight army bicycle across ploughed fields and so on. And
had you the same batman as you'd had from the beginning?
At that stage, yes. Private Loughran, regular. I wish I could remember when that was, because I think I'd been brought back from regimental headquarters, which was in a requisitioned house on the west side of Stockton. I think I'd been brought back to take over the company while Robert Blackett was away. I was in and out of regimental headquarters a great deal of the time. There were other courses they sent me on. I think probably the... What was the first one? Oh, a camouflage course. That was when we were on the beaches. They had a lot of film industry bods in, and we were supposed to make a pillbox look like a country cottage. They had techniques of reproducing brickwork, stonework, and what have you in some sort of jelly substance, and could then make big sections that could be slapped onto the outside of pillboxes and so on. But of course there was a great deal of emphasis not only on the physical alteration of defences, but a great deal of emphasis on track discipline. I remember being shown aerial photographs of wonderfully disguised and concealed positions, and from the aerial photograph obviously given away immediately by bad track discipline. Instead of going round in the shadow of the hedge, tracks leading right across the field. And even if the wire did show up as a slightly darker line from the air, the white tracks of somebody patrolling along the wire was an instant giveaway. I'm trying to think, what are the courses? I seem to be on endless courses. They sent me on a hygiene course at one stage. And I always felt that the derision before and after the course within the unit was not really merited. It wasn't just a buckets course, there were mainly MOs. I can't think where it was. It was probably a divisional course.
What aspects of hygiene were you learning on the course?
Great deal that sticks in my mind was anti-malarial measures. It was partly sanitary measures. They talked about a number of varieties. For instance, there was the Icelandic lily. Iceland being subject to severe gales, they made a joke of it and said that the MOs attached to the units in Iceland had numerous cases of people going out in the gale and the frozen spray causing slight puncture wounds in the face. So they had developed the Icelandic lily, which was a tubular urinal constructed out of petrol tins, around which the great coat could be wrapped and then perform in safety and comfort. I can't remember what the definition of the desert rose was, but that also cropped up. A little more pertinent was the measures to deal with the after effects of route marches, and the first priority being foot inspection.
What was the any additional things that they did with feet? You did a foot inspection. Was there something that you gave the men, or the men were supposed to do with their feet?
I think I don't know whether this was official or not, but I think we tried it out in D Company of getting hold privately of some meths to harden up the feet. I think it probably worked. It seemed to work with me personally.
Is there any other courses you recall?
I'm trying to think of any more. On the I also went, I think I was the only one out of the unit on this particular course. It was a battle training course, so-called, at Leyburn, on the fringes of the Catterick area. And that was, in fact, it was at the platoon commander level. And that was really battle training. It was on the attack side. It was practicing formation in attack formations in a variety of locations, in open country, in wooded areas, scrubland.
Was that with a platoon?
That was a platoon, yes.
And how do they differ?
And well, we were organised as a platoon, everybody on the course, and took it in turns to be the platoon commander, the platoon sergeant, the section leader, and so on. And a good deal of emphasis on the control of the platoon, hand signals, whistle signals.
Were these signals specific for a given movement or action?
Yes. The arms outspread, if I remember rightly, was for open formation. The hand on the head was close to me. I can't remember what how many whistle blasts for any particular thing. Dealing with wire in action, it would be a question of throwing bodies onto the Dunnet concertina wire to flatten it down. I think I've already said what my build was and what I weighed. And early on in this procedure, I happened to be the one to go on the wire. And the procedure was to belt up to the wire entanglement and to throw oneself face down onto the wire. We're wearing respirators on the chest. I don't think much thought was given to in this. It wouldn't have happened in action, but I don't think much thought was given on the course to whether or not the respirator hose was going to get punctured by the barbed wire or not. And thereafter, it was a question of these 12, 13 stone six-footers coming over and supposedly planting the leading foot between the shoulder blades on the way over the wire. It was quite often in the kidneys. But then it was a good battle training course.
Did the wire not puncture you?
To a certain extent, but it was really only the initial pricks that one felt. The thumps in the kidneys and between the shoulder blades took everything else out of one's mind.
How did you get off the wire?
With difficulty, with great difficulty. But by that time, after the rest of the platoon or the section, because it was done in sections, different sections of a length of Dunnet wire, it was usually a triple coil, and it was difficult for me, being not very tall. In other words, you had two coils on ground level and one on top between the two. And I don't think I ever got my face cut. Certainly got hands cut, which didn't help on the subsequent night exercises of, back again to it, trench digging in the dark. And night attacks, and the procedure to adopt when star shells went up.
What was that procedure?
Freeze. My other great memory is of getting back into the hutted camp at the end of the afternoon's exercise. It would be if we were going out again on a night exercise. The tea meal consisted of sandwiches, very often cheese. How many would there be? There'd probably be about 30 of us on the course. And being little, I got squeezed out quite often. I've never seen, officers or not, I've never seen anybody, because we were so ravenous, demolish food as rapidly and as ravenously as they did on that course.
Were you expected as an officer to put in a number of courses before any possibilities of promotion? Was that an expected procedure?
I think it was up to a point. I was never told when I got back to my unit that I'd disgraced the unit or I'd passed the course. I must have must have passed all right on the MCO's course, because there was some misdemeanour which brought a board of the East Yorks and myself up before the said Major General Shears, and we were returned to unit. The heck was it? I think it was some misdemeanour about mess etiquette or something like that. We'd lived in requisitioned buildings most of the time with a company commander. Oh, except for Major Harwood, I think they were pretty lax about sort of regulation misbehaviour. For a time, I'd been in the headquarters mess in West Hartlepool. Forget what north it was. Anyway, they still made me division to brigade to battalion motor contact officer in the end, so couldn't have been anything very serious. Some lark would got up to her.
I was going to ask you about mess. How was your mess organised?
In our own unit, we had a headquarters mess, which was first of all in a requisitioned fairly small house in West Hartlepool, and each company had its own mess in a requisitioned house.